Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Thursday, August 24, 2023. Some South Sudanese activists living in the diaspora say their country is not ready for elections.
Basically, there is still a lot of game being played at the moment, and the parties are not serious about peace and about the unity of the country.
And thousands of Sudanese refugees fleeing the conflict in Sudan face new challenges in Chad.
Since I am one of the refugees, so I see the pain of the people. We mainly targeted the women and the children because they are the most vulnerable. We have a small clinic and we have a small laboratory for minor investigation, and we have minor operation room for the wounds and the cleaning and stuff.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some South Sudanese activists say the parties to the revitalized peace agreement have done very little to create a suitable environment for the conduct of credible elections in 2024. One civil society activist with the Outlawed People's Coalition for Civil Action says he doubts a free and fair elections could be held in 2024. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar reports from Juba.
South Sudan is scheduled to hold elections in less than 15 months, according to country's roadmap for the extension of the transitional period. But some civil society activists are beginning to cast doubts on the government's ability to organize elections in 2024. Abraham Aolich, a member of the Outlawed People's Coalition for Civil Action, says parties to the agreement have not implemented key tasks for the conduct of a credible election.
Basically, there is still a lot of game being played at the moment, and the parties are not serious about peace and about the unity of the country, and they are not serious about the election. But they want to cheat. They want to conduct an election that will give them favorable outcome, and in the end, they will claim legitimacy.
Aolich says training and deployment of the necessary unified forces could create safe environment across the country for the conduct of a free and fair elections. Parties to the 2018 Revitalized Peace Agreement have traded accusations for the delays in implementing key provisions for the conduct of elections in December 2024. Kwal Atimbol, SPLM Secretary for Parliamentary and Executive Caucuses at the South Sudan's National Parliament, says the signatories to the 2018 peace agreement are implementing the task in the country's roadmap, adding that election-related institutions will be established in a few days.
The peace agreement will end up when the elections are conducted. You just expect the announcement within one week or even two weeks. The election commission will be established, and then the budget is already done, and everything is on the way.
Pok Bot Balwang, Director of Information for the Sudan's People's Liberation Movement in Opposition, or SPLMIO, says President Salva Kiir should be held responsible for the slow implementation of the 2018 peace agreement.
Anyone who's following the politics of South Sudan knows very well who's the pen holder and who's in charge of the resources in this country. You cannot accelerate the process of the implementation of the peace agreement without resources. There's a violation that has been carried out against the provisions of the agreement by the SPLMIG. Our commitment to the implementation of the peace agreement is unquestionable, because we know it is the only way that we can attain lasting peace in our country.
South Sudan's Minister of Information and Government spokesperson, Michael McQuay, has spoken publicly on several occasions assuring South Sudanese that President Salva Kiir will take the country for elections in December 2024. The United Nations Mission in South Sudan, the Troika, and the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, which monitors the implementation of South Sudan's peace agreement, have repeatedly said they are concerned about the slow progress in implementing the 2018 peace deal. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayor in Juba.
Still in Juba, the decision by South Sudan's transitional government of national unity to pay each of its 650 lawmakers at the National Legislative Assembly $15,000 as medical allowance has sparked angry reactions from South Sudanese, as Charlton Doki reports from Juba.
Juba resident Adiat Kur says the government's decision to pay each MP a $15,000 medical allowance has angered him. Kur says the money should have been channeled into developmental projects that would benefit many South Sudanese who need services in schools, hospitals, and health centers in remote parts of the country. He says it's unfair for the government to spend a huge amount of money on lawmakers while the country is experiencing a serious economic crisis.
And especially if one MP is being paid with such amount of money, another civil servant are not paid. It doesn't make sense. So if government have money, then this money should be used to pay the rest of the civil servants instead of giving such amount of money to each person.
Another Juba resident who prefers to be identified only as Philip for fear of reprisals from the authorities says paying MPs hefty medical allowances could create animosity between lawmakers and civil servants who have not been paid for many months.
$15,000 with this situation is quite complicated, actually. Majority of our citizens, they can get $100 just in a month. And if some people are getting $15,000, it's not balanced, actually. It's not balanced.
Bortown resident Daniel Anyeth Makwey says rather than accepting the medical allowance, MPs should advocate for the interest of the ordinary South Sudanese. He says the MPs should ensure the government pays the salaries of other civil servants and members of the security forces.
I condemned their act. They have to change such a spirit to speak on behalf of the people, then enriching themselves. Like in the previous year, they were given the allowance, they were given the car tokens, but the citizens have not got anything. The forces that are protecting the country have not get any tokens.
John Mayol, another Bor resident, says the government of South Sudan has no interest in the welfare of the ordinary people who are suffering from the country's economic challenges, including inflation.
The decision made by our government to approve up to $15,000 as a medical allowance to our national MPs is uncalled for. And we as South Sudanese condemn this because the country is facing a lot of challenges economically, including the inflation in the market. Many of the South Sudanese do not afford to buy basic needs, which are topped by the food.
Mayol says the money paid to MPs as a medical allowance should have been used to subsidize prices of essential commodities, including food, which many families cannot afford. Joel Nomugek Daniel, a lawmaker representing Choibet County in the National Legislative Assembly in Juba, told this program Wednesday that some lawmakers will use the 15,000 medical allowance for helping the needy in their various constituencies. Daniel added that lawmakers are entitled to medical allowance regardless of South Sudan's economic crisis. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Khartoum, where the French news agency says Sudan's army chief, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, was seen Thursday outside his headquarters for the first time since fighting erupted more than 4 months ago with paramilitaries. Army videos filmed before dawn and posted on the army's Facebook page showed Burhan speaking to soldiers, with the caption indicating that he was in Wad Sayidna Air Base, north of Khartoum. In separate daytime images posted later, he is seen surrounded by civilians in the capital's twin city of Omdurman. AFP could not verify the footage or images, but the agency's fact-checking department was able to determine that they had never been posted online before and therefore could very well have been taken on Thursday. The army has put out several statements and videos saying it has repelled attacks by the paramilitary rapid support forces since Sunday against Al-Shajara base. But the RSF claims it has taken control of much of it since Wednesday. More than 200,000 refugees fleeing Sudan's conflict have arrived in the town of Adrie, Chad, since the middle of June. Before the crisis, the town had a record population of 40,000. In this report, Henry Wilkins asks Adrie residents and newly arrived refugees what they are doing to help the vast influx of new residents.
Hagen Ali Zorgan is a humanitarian activist and resident of Adrie, a town in Chad across the border from Sudan's chronically troubled Darfur region. More than 200,000 Sudanese refugees have arrived in the town in recent weeks, fleeing fighting in Darfur and attacks against civilians. They've built makeshift shelters in the countryside that surrounds Adrie, as far as the eye can see. Dorgan says from a humanitarian perspective, people can't be left to suffer like this. They're very tired and sick. The latest arrivals were stuck in Janina, a town in West Darfur, for 3 months, he says. And some residents of Adrie have volunteered to help cook for refugees, bringing flour and sugar. That's humanitarian, he says. There are people, and we care about them. Zorgan has started a TikTok channel to raise awareness about the refugees' plight. He interviews them and documents local efforts to help them. His channel has attracted tens of thousands of views. Residents of the towns hosting the refugees, as well as refugees themselves, have been playing a vital role in assisting those in need, complementing the international response. Nonetheless, the suffering of the refugees in Adrie is great. Salima Abdallah Idris Ishak has just arrived carrying all of her possessions. She says ethnic Arab militia groups attacked civilians and pushed them out of Sudan. She says the militia groups told her family their home no longer belongs to them. They said the country belongs to the militias and her family don't have the right to anything in it. Some refugees have lent their skills to helping those like Ishak, who are newly displaced by the conflict. Dr. Mohamed Mustafa fled the Sudanese city of Janina, which has been ripped apart by the war 2 months ago. He now volunteers at this medical centre that non-profit set up in the Adrie camp.
Since I am one of the refugees, so I see the pain of the people. We mainly targeted the women and the children because they are the most vulnerable. We have a small clinic and we have a small laboratory for minor investigation, and we have minor operation room for the wounds and the cleaning and stuff, and we have a pharmacy.
The top official in Adrie says helping refugees is part of the fabric of the town. It previously welcomed refugees from the Darfur War that began in 2003. Kunal Ali Mohamed Sebi says refugees have been living with us for 20 years now, and they have the same rights and are equal to us. They've benefited from non-profits here, providing health and education. Thousands more refugees are expected to arrive in Adrie in the coming weeks and months, as the war in Sudan drags on. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Adrie, Chad.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, what is the impact of the Islamic State on Sudan's instability? Find out more after the break.
Think. People speak out on important questions. The question today:
where do you get your health advice from?
Sometimes I get my health advice from my grandmother, who is at home. When I'm sick that I can't control myself, she'll help.
I get my health advice from my friend, colleague, who live together. We also know about those who have been experiencing more problems about health. They don't advise me through phone. We talk, we chat, discuss everything.
My dad, because my dad is a doctor.
I'd say I get my health advice from various places, the internet, my parents, because my mother is a nurse.
My health advice, I get it on the internet. If I need something on how to deal with obesity, I get it on the internet. Anything I need pertaining to health advice is on the internet.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. While the Islamic State terror group continues to lose influence in Iraq, U.S. Major General Matthew McFarlane recently warned remnants still pose threats to areas not under the protection of the U.S.-led coalition, including parts of Syria. Analysts see Islamic State next expanding into Africa and Asia. For VOA News, Del Gavlak reports from Amman, Jordan.
U.S. Major General Matthew W. McFarlane commands the Combined Joint Task Force, Operation Inherent Resolve, based in Iraq, working to defeat Islamic State militants and prevent their resurgence. In an online briefing to journalists this month, McFarlane called the group ISIS as well as the Arab acronym Daesh, said Islamic State no longer controls any territory, has lost leaders and fighters, and carries out fewer attacks than in the past. He said there was a 65% reduction in Islamic State activity this year compared to last year.
They continue to degrade. Having said that, there are still radical fighters out there that aspire to reemerge or rebuild the caliphate. We work very closely with our Iraqi counterparts. We share intelligence to make sure we address any possible reemergence or any possible threats that emerge from those ISIS fighters that are still at large. We also work to address the long-term efforts like repatriation of IDPs and Daesh detainees that are in the detention facilities in Syria.
Stephen Heidemann, a non-resident senior fellow at Washington's Brookings Institution, told VOA that McFarlane gave a fairly balanced assessment of Islamic State at this time. However, Heidemann points to a recent United Nations report that says the Islamic State group still commands between 5,000 and 7,000 fighters in Syria and Iraq.
There's certainly no sense we can declare mission accomplished in terms of Operation Inherent Resolve. It continues to play an important role in degrading ISIS, and yet ISIS retains the ability to sustain pretty high levels of insecurity in eastern Syria and northwestern Iraq. We can't underestimate the extent to which local groups that publicly affiliate with ISIS have in some ways overtaken the core group as a source of threat. Africa is clearly one arena in which we're seeing that happen.
A South Africa-based analyst, Martin Iwe, has also warned of the growing threat in Africa, where Islamic State is active in more than 20 countries already. He cautioned that the continent may represent the future of the caliphate. Analyst Nicholas Harris at Washington's New Lines Institute tells VOA that Islamic State is like a perennial, dormant in the Middle East heartland, but regenerating and springing to life in Central Asia and Africa.
ISIS has numerous cells in Syria and has also established in that sort of western badlands of Iraq a support network. ISIS has tried to manage the reality that it is a organization that's looking for this opportunity to spring back. The ISIS brand globally has found opportunity to grow in Central Asia, particularly Afghanistan, but also it's looking to spread into Pakistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and is looking to try to take advantage of rising communal religious tensions in India.
Harris said that in Africa, Islamic State is trying to take advantage of the war in Sudan and the destabilization of Ethiopia. Del Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
From Amman, we go to Zimbabwe, where dozens of voting stations, voters brave long waits for ballot papers to be delivered, with some lining up all night. The delays forced President Emmerson Mnangagwa, who is seeking a second term, to issue a late-night directive extending Wednesday's vote by another day. Electoral Commission spokesperson Justin Manyau said voting was still underway in parts of the capital, Harare, and the eastern province of Manicaland. My colleague Yahya Swihib talked to reporter Jose Zenvashi in Harare about the latest.
Yes, voting is still going on in some of the polling stations. So yesterday, the president had to issue a statutory instrument instructing that there'll be an extension in the voting period. So you find that yesterday, some people had to vote under the cover of darkness. Some polling stations only started serving people as late as 7 p.m., some at 9 p.m., some even started serving people today. So that's the situation that we have on the ground regarding voting.
Zimbabwe has a history of, violent and disputed elections. And Mnangagwa just claimed Zimbabwe to be a master of democracy, criticizing Western countries that expressed concern about the credibility of the polls a few weeks ago. And his main challenger, Nelson Chamisa, is describing the election as a sham, claiming that the voting delays were aimed at disfranchising voters in his urban strongholds. What do you hear about that?
Yes. So Chamisa maintains that this election has been a sham, even though they are recording victories. So some results have started coming in, and both parties are making gains. You find that some of the highly contested seats, there's news filtering in that the opposition has won. But this has always been the trend with election results, particularly urban areas. Results from urban areas usually are the first that start trickling in, and they give an impression that the opposition is going for a landslide victory. And then the rug is pulled under their feet when results from rural areas start also coming in. So we're yet to see where it goes, but the position of the main opposition is that this election is a sham, but this has not dampened their spirits. This has not stopped them from celebrating the victories that are coming in.
Kudzai, what does the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission say about all this?
So in regards to the delays, they are linking this to the court cases that were ongoing in the build-up to this, from the nomination court period building up to the voting time, to the voting period. So they are linking this delay to that, to say we couldn't vote before the courts made a decision on who goes on the ballot paper, because there were a lot of contestations regarding, there were a lot of court cases about people filing court papers late, therefore they were not eligible to contest. Some people were contesting the aspect that they had the local currency and tried to pay, but there were delays in that regard. So there were a lot of these court cases. So that's what they are linking this delay to. But you find that in Kwazana, where Charlton Wende, one of the main opposition's member of parliamentary candidates, he said the ballot papers for his constituency, he was notified yesterday that they were being printed yesterday. So that's where the delay was. So you find that there are also reports that some of these ballot papers were literally printed yesterday on election day.
And the day after, Kudzai, what is the general mood?
Well, the mood now is a bit, I think there is a bit of mixed feelings. So the messaging from the opposition is that people should stay vigilant, people should be patient and still vote, because they feel like there's a tactic to discourage the urban population, which is their stronghold. And you find that people in urban areas do not have time to stand around and wait for many hours to cast a ballot paper. They would want to go about their lives and go and take care of their families and go on about their lives. This is unfamiliar territory for anyone in Zimbabwe. We have never been in this part. We've never had such a delay before. So it's these are uncharted waters.
That's reporter Jose Zenvashi speaking to my colleague Yehes Wihip from Harare, Zimbabwe. Still on election matters, U.S. Republican presidential candidates sparred sharply on a host of issues Wednesday night in the first debate leading to the 2024 national election. But some of the most spirited comments targeted the candidate who skipped the political confrontation, former President Donald Trump, the party's leading contender.
The two-hour debate, the first held by Republicans in this election cycle, featured spirited exchanges about what one of the moderators called the elephant who is not in the room, the absent party frontrunner, former President Donald Trump. Some of the contenders, such as Trump's former Vice President Mike Pence and former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, deemed Trump disqualified from serving again because of what they said was his disrespect for the Constitution, as well as the more than 90 felony counts he now faces. Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley declared, "Trump is the most disliked politician in America. We can't win a general election that way." However, political novice Vivek Ramaswamy, rising in the polls, stood by Trump, saying he believed he was the best president of the 21st century. Ramaswamy also stood apart in questioning American support for Ukraine, saying China is a bigger threat to the United States than Russia. Several other candidates, including Haley, also a former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, expressed strong support for Ukraine in defending itself against Russian forces. After the debate, Pence told reporters no one should have been surprised by his vigor on the debate stage.
"And I was the leading champion of conservative values in the Trump-Pence administration. I know how to fight, and I was happy to bring that fight tonight."
Pence's primary sparring opponent of the evening, Ramaswamy, said he relished the verbal barrages directed at him by the former vice president.
"Mike Pence kept coming at me with that with the experience differential. I think that's a great thing, because I don't think the people in this country are interested in going back to people who recite slogans they memorized in 1980.
The Republicans hold their second debate next month in California, but only one of the candidates will be back here on the same stage in Wisconsin next July to accept the party's nomination. Steve Herman, VOA News, Milwaukee.
And that's all we prepared for you this Thursday, August 24, 2023. We now leave you with Emmanuel Jal and the song "We Want Peace."
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah, I'm looking for some people who's looking for peace. Maybe together we could make the war cease. Now we can send mankind to the moon, and we can reach to the bottom of the sea. That's why it really kind of baffles me that we cannot end wars and bring peace. And we cannot change the way people act, and we cannot change the way people think. So if we sit back, chill out and relax, civilization will soon be extinct. That's why I am. People living in Darfur, the world gone deaf, the world gone blind, the world busy sitting down on the behind. Nobody cared about the poor.
We've been listening to Emmanuel Jal and the song "We Want Peace." Don't forget to visit voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you miss this program, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer Killer Williams, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Would you help me?